You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. Very happy to have you with us on this Monday, July the 16th. It's coming up on about 10 minutes past 8 o'clock right now. We are going to talk with the author of the new book, Deer Hunting with Jesus, this hour, Dispatches from America's Class War. And Joe Bagent writes in his book, "To non-hunters, the image conjured up by the title of this book might seem absurd, rather like a Nuke the Whales bumper sticker. But the title also captures something that moves me about the people I grew up with, the intersection between hunting and religion in their lives. The link between Protestant fundamentalism and deer hunting goes back to colonial times when the restless Presbyterian Scots, along with the English and German Protestant reformers, pushed across America, developing the unique hunting and farming-based frontier cultures that sustained them over most of America's history. 200 years later, they have settled down, but they have not quit hunting, and they have not quit praying." We will talk with Joe Bagent this hour and welcome your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. In the book, he chronicles the lives and views of the working class neighbors in his hometown of Winchester, Virginia. And we start to understand why these small-town residents who have no health care, no college education, and not much of an income vote Republican. And Joe Bagent also says that progressives could learn some lessons from all of this, and we'll find out about that as well. Joe Bagent, until recently, worked as senior editor for the Weeder History Group. He writes an online column, joebagent.com. He is the author of Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War. Good morning.
Good morning. That's about the best introduction I've ever heard.
Well, that's because I read from your book.
Well, it sets up the context. A lot of times, the questions come out of the blue with no context.
Yeah, it was really a fascinating read. And I tell us about your hometown and growing up in Winchester, Virginia.
Well, Winchester, it's actually almost, except for its long history, most of the country doesn't have the East Coast depth of history, but it's very typical of all the stuff between the cities, you know, the towns, the rural towns, the communities. We're about 26,000 people, properly speaking, and then that many more out in the county. And it occurred to me how typical Winchester was and the existence of a huge working class that was unacknowledged everywhere I went, in Oregon and, you know, upstate New York, the Midwest, the South, really. You can find these same large bodies of unacknowledged working people anywhere in America. What they're calling Red State America might be a rural urban divide, or it might be. The one thing that is certain is nobody sees themselves as working class. They all see themselves as middle class.
Yeah, why do you think that is?
Well, it's the sell job. You know, it's the sell job of the great, what do you call it, the market hallucination. We're all middle class. Well, here's the way I would break it down. About 19% of Americans graduate from a legitimate university, you know, college or university. 22%, if you count a lot of the technical and trade schools in which you'll never hear the word Shakespeare or never learn any depth of world history. 27%, if you believe the Bush administration right now. That means, at best, 4 out of 5 people never get a college degree. Not that it's the end of the earth or the most important thing, but that leaves them. Class is about power, not about money. There are a lot of truck drivers that make nearly as much as a lower-level college professor, but class is about power. And if you go to work and the man tells you when to go to work, when to take a break, when you get lunch, whether you'll get benefits, when to take your vacation, how much you're going to make an hour or a week, and when to take a walk when he doesn't need you anymore. That's called working class. But the American public has been sold on the idea that everybody is, quote, middle class. The hospital technician in the white coat and the clean environment that's doing it for $10 an hour is locally is working class. But they don't see it that way because the images in media and everything, they go back to some kind of a blue-collar William Bendix type that works at the plant. But really, truly, by people in service industries and all these other things, they are working class. Many people that consider themselves self-directed, semi-professionals. Look, if you're doing it for $32,000 a year and working 45 hours a week, and the man tells you when he doesn't need you anymore, it's working class.
Yeah. And most of the, many of the folks in Winchester are working at the Rubbermaid factory?
Well, that's one plant. I just picked that one because I knew more about it. But it's not just at the plant. Actually, Rubbermaid's a good job. Despite the situation that was described there, it's a good job in this town. Now, everyone has been pretty much reduced to some kind of service industry. There was a huge construction boom, like the rest of the country, as all the people trying to migrate out of the snarl of traffic in D.C. built huge homes out in the county here. Well, now, right now, those same people who, construction workers and so on, who had it so good during the boom, not that good, because most of the construction workers were Latin Americans, because they still know how to lay stone and all this. But anyway, they're knocking on my door right now asking if I need some rooms painted or some baseboard fixed. So these are, you know, they have no job security, and yet they feel like they're middle class. They don't have any health insurance. You know, I don't know what to say about it except that there's this big illusion just because you got a new truck, you know, which was made available through usurious interest rates and so on. So it's an illusion. It's a great illusion, and a lot of people are suffering. But they're pretty tough people. They work hard. You know, all these Scots-Irish descendants and Poles and Germans. And, you know, they work hard. They don't complain. They're very patriotic. And yet their anger is manifest at what they perceive and what they've been told. Remember, they've been told this for 50 years in anti-union efforts and so on. They look at TV and they see Seinfeld or Sex and the City, this fickle, vapid illusion that this is what urban liberalism is. They don't see themselves on television ever. If they do, it's My Name is Earl, which I laugh at. I mean, it's a crazy show, but I mean, let's have a little broader. Somewhere in the 50s and early 60s, we quit seeing representations of working class people with dignity.
Well, the working class people of Winchester, though, you talk about how they own homes or mobile homes.
Yeah, well, it depends on where you are. Now, the section of town that I grew up in and the section I write about, it's not the entire city. Tourists come through and they say, oh, God, it's a gorgeous, historic city. Well, yeah, you're going through exactly where the Chamber of Commerce wants you to go through. But if you go over in the section of town I grew up in, when I was growing up there, there were plenty of men swinging a lunchbox on the way to work and coming home and paying for a house. These might not have been the greatest houses in the world. They might have been little post-World War II cracker boxes. Or here we have tons of ancient old architecture going back to the Revolutionary War. But they owned their homes. Now they're renting them, and in many cases from slumlords, the very homes they owned. And it's all happened in the last 30 years, and it has to do with things like the first big medical bill with no insurance during the layoff. You know, cost you $25,000, and you had to refi your house twice. And the next medical bill, you're putting it out over three credit cards. And then, of course, the Republicans say, well, it's personal responsibility. You can't handle money. Well, they accept that. They accept all these as their own personal failure. They don't say, oh, everybody deserves health insurance. They don't think that way. They don't even think politically. And we have to stop and understand that whether it's a working-class, rundown working-class neighborhoods of my hometown or Moline, Illinois, or Springfield, Oregon, most Americans, even in the gated communities, have a sixth-grade understanding of history, politics, and economics. And that's the truth. So they're never going to put two and two together and get four.
Yeah, I was referring to, though, you thought a lot of people were going out on a limb and taking these risky mortgages and being taken advantage of by those offering the risky mortgages.
Well, when you have bad credit, see, you're going to eat a lot of points on subprime lending.
Yeah, and you had dire predictions of how this was going to turn out.
Well, it's already happening.
Mm-hmm, right.
it's already happening. The guy that was in the book that talks about mortgages and, you know, makes mortgages and creates mortgages says that they have so many walkaways, they call them, or people that call and say, I want to give the house back. And they say, wait 6 months, we're going to work something out, because nobody wants to see the tidal wave of foreclosures come down in an already lousy market. And the bad economic news. So there are people now living all over the United States in brand new houses that they can't pay for, that they got on loans that could never possibly pay back. And they're sitting there, not making any payment until the government does some kind of a bailout for the mortgage companies. So it's a bit like the savings and loan.
So, Joe, why do these small-town residents who are renting or in lousy housing, who have no health care, who don't have a college education and aren't making much money, why are they voting Republican?
Because nobody, either liberal or conservative, Republican or Democrat, votes for logical reasons, adds up the points and does it. They vote, people vote emotionally. They vote from the gut. I know that we liberals like to think we're all rational and we point to this and we point to that. But really, most people vote for emotional reasons.
And what are the emotional reasons that are causing them to vote Republican?
Well, for starters, if you're among the working poor or just hardworking classes that it's always a stretch and a reach to get by, you're conservative by nature. It pays to be conservative by nature. And so that's associated with the politics, too. You know, vote for caution, vote for restraint. If vote for repression if necessary, whatever it takes to hold things together. That's one reason. Then, of course, there's a certain demonization. Here you have a latent anger that's not going to be expressed openly. All the noise you hear from Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh, that's just the media figures, you know, or the Strom Thurmonds or whatever. But the person holds in the anger. My feeling is they hold in the anger and then that comes into play in the voting booth when they demonize liberals and Clinton and all that. So a lot of emotional things come into play there. The other thing is that the Democrats just don't reach people anymore. They don't have a grassroots work. They think they do, but everybody's liberals have more fun, and it's really hard to get them to get down there with the guys with the plumber butts that don't know jack about politics and get down there and help educate some people and lead them out of their ignorance. Because that's what it takes. Like Malcolm X said, first we must educate the people.
We are talking with Joe Bagent. He is author of the book Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War. And we welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock, talking with her guest about all of the major news of the week last week. That's the All Things Political Hour coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking all things cultural and political this hour with Joe Bagent, who is author of Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War, in which he interviews his friends and neighbors in Winchester, Virginia, to try to understand their culture, why people with little income or education would be voting for Republicans. And I'm wondering, Joe Bagent, you grew up with in this town, and you described this as three-quarters of Americans who do not go to college, the NASCAR-loving, church-going, gun-owning America who has never set foot in a Starbucks. What was different for you? Why did you not vote conservative, but instead turn into a commie liberal?
I'm lucky. Oh. That's why. No. Well, I quit school in the 11th grade. I went in the Navy just to get out, you know, I mean, like so many other people. I got a GED and then later, you know, went to school and so on. I'm not so unique, really. The thing is that the ones that get out never come back. for instance, the people that make the best grades and get all the scholarships or kind of get cherry-picked out of there by the universities, the people that were different when I was growing up, people I could talk to, I mean, I had that kind of same take on life even when I was a teenager in a weird way. It took the 60s to bring it to fruition and actually give it a philosophy. But the people I went to school with that were like me, they're not here. And that's the thing. We get the impression, I'm not so unique. You know, everybody went to fundamentalist churches and same schools and same values around them. But I look around and none of them are here. And now that the book's come out, of course, you get emails from everybody you ever knew, which is wonderful. And I find them in San Francisco, and I find them where there's a living in places where there's an intellectual life. I'm sure they moved to Minneapolis and Madison up where you are, and yet I'm absolutely sure, too, that you go outside of Minneapolis and Madison, I can find you plenty of deer hunters. And in fact, I think Wisconsin is home to the Christian Deer Hunters Association.
It could be. I know there's a lot of deer hunting here.
You have the Christian Deer Hunters Association up there.
Yeah, and what's the significance of that?
Well, you would be surprised. You would be surprised. I got to know the fellow and read some of his books and everything. Basically, they use deer hunting these days is pretty much taking a stand or being in a stand or alone and by yourself out in the woods a long time. These guys use it as a time to meditate, and they take their Christian meditations with them in a little tiny pocketbook, or they reflect on God's bounty, the creation of nature, and so on. And as I've tried to point out in the book, this is a chain of cultural associations, you know, that go back a long way to the frontiers and to the Blue Ridge Mountains and the Scots-Irish and a lot of other things that these things are bound together in an agrarian and hunting culture way more than the average person realizes, you know. If it today, it just has snowmobiles, that's all.
Yeah. Lots of callers who want to talk with you. Let me go to the phone. Steve in Appleton is with us first. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just seem like I'm the guy that he's talking about here, the working stiff that tends to vote more Republican than Democrat. I just wanted to say that basically, I mean, the reason that I look that way towards the Republicans more than the Democrats don't seem to talk to the working person anymore. You know, I know about the free trades and who signed them in, the free trade agreements, and jobs disappearing. I know every time it seems like you listen to the Democrats, they're more concerned with, you know, gun control, abortion, you know, things like that that, you know, we know they're legal, they're out there. We're not so concerned with it. We're more concerned with paying our bills and making ends meet. And you know, it's the Republicans that talk about, you know, keeping down taxes. You know, I used to be a Teamster, and my dad was, and, you know, it was Jimmy Carter that basically deregulated trucking, which is what I'm doing right now, driving a truck, that cut our wages terribly and really screwed up the Teamsters Union. You know, it just, on so much, it kind of turned the other direction.
Losing you a little bit on the cell phone, Steve, but Steve, sound familiar to you, Joe Bajant?
I think he did the best job of outlining it I've heard on any of these calls, and I've had almost 100 of them now. That is so well put. The only distinction I would make is don't kid yourself that the Republicans are any more on your side. What it is we have one party in this country, and it's the party of business. And the party of business has two faces, the Republican and the Democratic face. They get their money from the same big contributors. But the unforgivable sin the Democrats have done is at first they pretended the working class didn't exist and everybody was going to be a yuppie with big 401ks, and finally they forgot the working class existed. Well, they haven't been out there in the streets or associating with any of them for over 35 years. The Republican takeover wasn't this big, magic, steady march, although they were fairly organized as political parties go in America. But it was by default that the Democrats handed over, you know, their connection with real working life in America. Well, don't kid yourself that the Republicans have any closer one. They just knew how to exploit the situation. The fact of the matter is, though, the jobs are shipped out by everybody. You know, and there's, you know, your candidate is pre-selected. It's pre-selected by huge corporate business and banking interests. And that's it. The poorest guy on the list right now is Barack Obama. he declared $950,000 last year. You know, I know for a fact he got $3 million for his book because I have the same editor. But anyway, or Edwards, who charges $55,000 for a speech on poverty. The Westchester Country Club up there that masquerades as the Democratic Party is the one that shoots themselves in the foot about issues, these phony issues about stem cells and guns. And all those are smokescreen compared to the robbery that's going on, because the greatest amount of wealth out there to be extracted is from a penny at a time, from the great masses, working masses. And no matter who we elect in the present system, the illusion of two parties, we're going to get the same thing happen, only on different terms.
Yeah. And you do rail against the Democrats or gun control advocates in the book to a certain extent, saying that's one of the reasons why those who go deer hunting with Jesus don't vote Democratic is the gun control issue, Joe Bajan.
It's the biggest one. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the one that's vocal. It's the one the Democrats never say anything that happens inside your home. But, you know, we got 200 million guns in private hands in the United States. And they're not going to change it. They're not going to take everybody's guns away. And it's absolute hubris the way they look at middle America out here in the heartland or even in the cities, what citizen gun owners do. The fact of the matter is that it's like a tool. It's like a barbecue grill. And to my friends and relatives, it's 110 pounds of meat in the freezer. And that's it. You know, that's what it is. It's a tool. It's a traditional tool. It has roots in my family. It has roots in passing from father to son. But a lot of urbanites, you know, they watch too much television or something, because you know what the safest record for handling private guns in the home? New York City. It's got 3.5 million guns and the lowest rate of accidental shootings, you know. So they really got to, you know, they got to get over this, you know. But unfortunately, though, as the gun legislation, particularly of 1967, got passed, this anti-gun industry grew up and fans of stupid flames of a non-debate. And you know, Democrats, I love Democrats, don't get me wrong. In essence, they were great people when it started out, but they're no longer. But they fall for everything. It's almost like a bullfighter's cape in the Republican hands. You wave abortion, and they die for it. You wave guns, they die for it. How about standing up and saying, hey, how come so many people on my street, their kids got rotten teeth? How come they're one house payment away from losing their home? How come? And they won't stand there. And I ain't saying you got to take the streets, but in essence, you do. Some way you have to, and they're not doing it.
Let's go now to Scott in Green Bay. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Good morning. I guess I just wanted to echo your guest comments, because if you take any historical context, you start with 1960, the year 2000, and the Democrats and Republicans split the White House 20 years each. But they owned, the Democrats did, the House and the Senate and the government, Governor Manchin. And it just seems like they've kind of lost touch, lost their way. They have just morphed into one party more than anything else. Both parties have.
Yeah. All right. Anything further on that, Joe?
Well, what we have is a political elite, a class, political elites. It doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat. It matters if we're one of the power elites and you're up there and we watch them grapple between each other for power. But if you stop and think about it, look at the amount of coverage that's on how much money so-and-so raised. Well, he's only raised $23 million. He hadn't got a chance. They've reduced all of the discussion and dialogue and framing, as Lakoff calls it, to their own terms of elites in power. I don't care who's raising how much money. That's all I'm hearing. It's like a horse race. Who's got the most tens of millions? No, it's a nice way not to have to talk about what you're for, you know. But on the other hand, with what's coming, and I'm absolutely convinced, I've been very fortunate of being a newsman and an editor and so on, and living near D.C. now, to talk to some of the top people in the government and finance and economics, and everybody's pretty much convinced what's going to happen next for everybody, not just working people. When that does happen, I mean, the bubble, housing bubble is only the first part of it. then the ground will be ripe for real populism. And then you're going to hear all the same cast of characters talk about how they're all populist now. They're all populist, or they will be soon, you know. And I don't know what to say about it, except there really isn't anybody on your side up there. Very few. You get one once in a while, you know, Wellstone and this and that and the other. But in general, you're talking about power elites that reach all the way down to the state level. Mm-hmm. The game's got to be played the way it's got to be played, or you're not going to be there to be voted for.
Yeah. Let's go to Rich and Sullivan next. Hi, you're on the air.
Thanks for this program. Mm-hmm. I think the attack is already underway on John Edwards, which basically says that he's a phony and he's sort of a typical pseudo-reformed urban liberal person because of the amount of money he spends on his haircuts. And I also see some other candidates like Barack Obama as potentially a sort of breakthrough candidate in terms of reforming America's divide and conquer attitude between people, this is a horrible phrase, but people of color and the rest of us. And I want your guest's opinion about the demonization of people like the Kennedys, who are also labeled as phony liberals because they have money. And there's a media campaign that's on again and again that basically says, if you came from basic roots and you now have means, that you're not to be trusted, even while we're told that someone like George W. Bush is just a down-home guy hacking away at brush on his ranch in Crawford, Texas. And people buy it, and I choke on it. It is just absolutely the most bizarre triumph of media over realism, political realism, that I have witnessed in my lifetime. And I'm old enough to have witnessed quite a bit. So.
Joe?
Well, he's exactly right. I mean, okay, the elections are reduced to a televised popularity contest with people voting from their gut. You know, that's pretty much what it is. And as he was saying about Edwards and the haircuts and everything, when I bang at the Democrats, I bang at them and hope that they'll wake up. If you meet John Edwards' relatives, you'll find some of the humblest, nicest, hardworking, unpretentious people in the world that'll bring you Jell-O and soup molds with carrots in it, you know? He should stick to that. But I'll tell you what, I've been around a lot of politicians and being a journalist around all kinds of magic somebodies. And what happens to you once you reach a certain level of acclaim, to use a biblical metaphor, it is like being all this can be yours. And you do get tempted by the devil, as it were, you know. Edwards has to stop. You know, if you grow up in relatively simple circumstances, middle class or lower middle class or whatever, it's easy to be sucked into it. And, you know, that'll be his downfall if he doesn't stick to his roots. Look at Jim Webb. Mm-hmm. We had a Democratic victory here. Jim is I don't agree with everything that he says, but he is one hard-ass redneck at heart, a Scots-Irishman that is a true populist. When he wore those darn boots, it was part stunt, but when he wore his son's combat boots, and he'll take them off when his son gets back from Iraq and he confronted George Bush, I was really surprised at how well that played here among people who considered themselves Republicans, because there was anger down under there. You know, there was. And he talks about, boy, he gets more and more populist with every statement he makes. You know, he's getting down and wrestling with it. And he's gained popularity since he got elected here. I'm really surprised. And then once he's had a stage, well, these other guys, they should think like that. They should have some nerve, don't listen to the committee, don't listen to the strategist. Listen to your heart and look at your people.
You want to comment on, Rich wondered what you thought about Barack Obama somehow being the bridge between people of color and the rest of us.
Well, I'll tell you what, he may be managed to pass for black yet, but no, black people I know here don't believe it. He's a second-generation Harvard lawyer. He grew up in the whorehouse of Chicago politics. He's very attractive, and like I said, it's a televised popularity contest. Liberals want to believe I know a lot of blacks that want to believe. But I'll tell you what, he acts white enough to get elected. That's what's going on. What he's got to do is convince people he's really black. Of course, he doesn't have to convince liberals because they've been praying for this for years. But
and I don't know if maybe we should make the distinction that the people you're writing about in your book, those who go deer hunting with Jesus, are not blacks. These are whites, right?
They're whites. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that look, man, I live in what was the Jim Crow South until very darn recently. I was there when schools were integrated, and even now it's not pretty. But it isn't racism at it. You know, I know everybody wants to cling to that, and there is racism. There certainly is, you know, but people have been working together for a long time at the working class level. I don't know anybody that working class guys that hate blacks. It just doesn't, it's a whole two generations since then. So that isn't really it. It's the thinness, the thin values and the talking and, I don't know how to explain it. It's really nothing there. He says all these wonderful, wonderful, inspiring-sounding things that have nothing inside of them. You know, at least the Republicans give you somebody to be mad at.
And when you called Jim Webb a redneck, you meant that in a positive way.
You're darn right. I don't think, my people are proud to be who we are. You know, you take what would have been a slur and turn it around backwards. But the fact of the matter is, the first rednecks, probably the striking miners at the Ludlow Massacre, they tied red bandanas around their neck, and they were seen as an ugly, surly, working brute, and they were shot down, for striking for unions. The definition that we tend to use today probably came out of the Civil Rights era and Southerners and, the sun on their neck. But I take these things proudly as a banner. Yep, I'm a redneck, and I don't see anything particularly wrong with it, of course, with the stereotyping that goes on. I mean, there's a lot of difference between, if you live here, you know the difference between a bubba, a redneck, and white trash.
there is a difference, but you also say that the redneck is not just somebody who lives in the South, it's they're all over the country.
I've seen them everywhere. I went, boy, you got a lot of them in Wisconsin. I mean, you take away the accent and the snow.
Yeah, and the difference between a redneck, say, and white trash?
Well, rednecks work themselves to death from the time they get up to the time they go to bed all their lives, and then they fall over dead. White trash have no particular problem with not working.
There we go. We're talking with Joe Bagent. He is author of Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you between 9 and 11. Talking first about all things political, recapping all the major news from Washington after 9 o'clock, and then after 10, talking with the lead authors of a new study on the emotional impact on overweight children, how they are stigmatized and face all sorts of biases. That's coming up after 10 o'clock. Back to the phones now for Joe Bagent, who is author of Deer Hunting with Jesus, and Ivy in Evansville is with us next. Hi, Ivy, you're on the air.
Hi, I really appreciate this conversation. My background is a child brought up in the East Coast, daughter of parents who met as young Republicans. But they taught me to think, though, and I have liberal ideas, and I'm a strong environmentalist. I have to say, though, I took up hunting about 6 years ago when I got a short hair, so I'm not opposed to things like that at all. I find that friends of mine who are bird watchers and really love birds have strong right-wing values at the same time. Like, they'll tell me they listen to Rush Limbaugh, and that and when I bring up his environmental attitude, they say, well, sometimes he's wrong about things. And all I can figure is that somehow both Republicans, well, mainly Republicans in my view, have convinced people, these are hardworking people, that they could have what upper class Republicans have, but they're so close to the edge. I mean, if any of these folks lost their job, they would be relying on social services. And they're convinced by this group that social welfare, social programs are all evil. And I just don't understand how they can't see that they're close to the edge, too, and that this is good for society. Now, the Democrats disappoint me because they have no guts anymore. I mean, they're better environmentally, but they have no guts to go all the way and stand up for people and protect our water resources and all that. They just, you know, pander to... They just follow the... Whatever issue the right wing brings up, you know, if it's abortion, or which is an important issue, yeah. But... whatever they bring up, they just follow along, like moral values or something. They have no, they don't bring up their own issues, like, hey, the water's polluted. Hey, isn't it weird we can't eat the fish in Wisconsin? You know, I just don't see them standing up and bringing up issues on their own. They just yeah. follow whatever the right wing brings up.
Ivy, thank you for all those examples. What's a redneck to do, Joe, in Wisconsin?
Well, the first, yeah, we can't eat the fish here either, and it breaks my heart. I grew up as a child along the Shenandoah River, and I look at it, and all our fish are bisexual now.
Oh, no.
All this. No, really, truly, from PC bees. Mm-hmm. No. Well, what she said is, it certainly seems right to me. I thought she hit an interesting point, because I say that, and a lot of people challenge me on it. You know, a whole lot of people that are fixing cars and driving trucks and doing things think that they can really are going to get rich, that this is a land of opportunity where they can. But the fact of the matter is, it isn't. You know, you don't get a Bill Clinton very often for president. If you look at how many people are, like Gore Vidal's last book about how many people are related to everybody, and he's related to all of them, and it always has been a fairly elite class with a few exceptions. And the average person is not going to be president of the United States, and he's not going to be a millionaire. He's just not. But there's a myth that if you work hard enough, that'll happen. That's just not so. You have to have assets to do that, you know. And it's like college education. Most of the people in my class don't really expect their kids to go to a four-year university, though they might send them, might be a technical school or something. But if you don't have a home to refinance, which is the number one source of educational funds in America and families, if you don't have equity in your house, your kid's not going to go. Well, we've just eliminated four-fifths of the working class right there now. Four-fifths. But like she said, there's this Horatio Alger myth that's just not true. It's never been true, by the way. It's never been true. If you're born in a certain economic realm, you'll probably die in that realm, yeah. You know, statistically.
And she's right in that the working class that you're describing also don't care much for the social welfare programs?
No, because there's the feeling that somebody's getting something for nothing. Mm-hmm. And, hey, there's nothing wrong with somebody getting something for nothing if they need it. But there's this anxiety about the size of the pie, and they're getting part of my share, and, hey, I work my guts in the ground with two jobs. No, somebody shouldn't get something for nothing.
Yeah, I was interested in her comment that she knows some bird watchers who listen to Rush Limbaugh. She thinks that most bird watchers are conservative, even though conservative is not so in the environmental sense.
You know, I know about a dozen bird watchers, and I only know one that's a Democrat. I don't know what. That's weird.
Really? That's funny.
Yeah. That's a weird one.
All right. Thank you, Ivy, for the call. Tom in Burlington is with us. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I grew up in Virginia. It's a beautiful state next to Wisconsin. They can compete with each other for beauty. But getting back to this idea, I was reading a people losing their homes and the bankers taking over. I read a quote by... of all people, Henry Ford, the father of the Model T and the Model A, and he said, if Americans knew how badly the bankers were cheating them, they would shoot every banker they'd see. And it struck me as a kind of a wild quote, and I don't know exactly if it's true. But what we're losing people, our people are losing their homes, and the Congress is letting the banks regulate themselves. In my neighborhood, we've had three people have lost their homes. One woman, she lived there 25 years, And another man, he's lost his home. It's been foreclosed. And he's a Republican, and he's a staunch Republican, and he can't put two and two together or connect the dots that one of the reasons that he lost his home is because this deregulation of banks has been, it's outrageous, and something really has to be done about it. Mm-hmm. And getting back to your other point of this Horatio Alger myth, they did this study. They asked these kids how much they were going to make after they got out of school. And they all had these incredible numbers. I'm going to make $100,000 a year, or I'm going to win the lottery. And it was such an unbelievable fantasy about the reality of life.
Yeah. Joe?
So that's what kids do on television when they graduate, don't they? You know, it's an illusion. It's a cultural illusion. That was interesting to go back to what you said about people losing their homes, business and government working together to extract money from the people. Well, when business and government work together against the people, the actual name for that is called fascism. But to step back a moment from it, how money is created in the United States. If I go borrow $400,000 to buy a home, and I sign my name, and I say I owe $400,000, I haven't paid a penny of it back yet, I have just created $400,000 that the Fed can print, that the banks can loan. In fact, the banks can loan $800,000 because they get to loan it based on your promise to pay back, and then they get to loan it again, you know, through the Fed. Well, the average person does not understand that is the reason why he's never going to be a millionaire. The extraction of any surplus wealth created by individuals working with their hands, the guy that's greasing your Prius or whatever, you know, is sucked away before they ever see it. So the person losing their home, and I count them every day on the back. There were five today. It's a little black-edged box, you know, on the back of the paper. They don't understand that financial forces leverage things around the world. It's no longer your local bank or even an American mortgage company necessarily. Capital is leveraged from all over the world, whether it be London or Rome or Brussels or New York. They don't understand that they lose their home to forces like that. It doesn't matter if the whole damn country goes down because something else will go up, and now that capital is global, there isn't any great American flag anybody can wave and say, we're going to save Americans from this. Neither party can really promise you much of anything. There's no money there. There hasn't been for a long time, and there's even less now, thanks to the war and other debts. So how is the average person ever going to grasp what Henry Ford said?
Yeah. Joe, why do you call your book, or why is your book being called a call to arms for progressives?
Well, you know, God, I'm certainly a progressive. I think mm-hmm. I'm far enough left that I have to send up smoke signals to talk mm-hmm. to the Democratic Party. But that used to be the left, or it used to be the middle left, the things that I like. I didn't call it a call to arms. My editor did, but I went, well, that's the way she read it, and she's a nice upper-middle-class Jewish New York urbanite, you know? And most of their readers are going to be somewhere well, that's what we thought, but it's turning out that a lot of hardworking school teachers and other people are reading it, too. But, yeah, it is. It is, you know? If I say some bad things about progressives, it's only because I love progress, you know? And I had to smack myself in the head to become aware that, oh, my Lord, the movers and the shakers in this world don't even know my people exist. And then I went, oh, my Lord, the Democratic Party doesn't know we exist. And it just kind of, my heart's with them. I've certainly been a middle-class person until recently when I just quit doing it. Now I live on $4,000 a year and donate all the rest of the book proceeds and everything to Third World Development, but that's an old man's choice. But the thing of it was, yeah, it is a call to arms. It's saying, come on, let's wake up. Learn to know who your brothers are out there, even if you don't go to the taverns, you don't go to the Elks Club, you don't go to the church or the plant. For God's sake, know who we are. Because, you know, once you're raised in that, it never leaves you. It never goes out of your heart. Your values are always that same way.
Our next caller is Eldon in Duluth. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Just had a couple questions. I was kind of confused in the original thing. You talked a lot about how most Americans aren't middle class, that they're working class. I was kind of wondering how you make the differentiating between working class and middle class, because I thought you could kind of be both I'm just kind of interested in what your criteria is. And then also you say a lot about how voters, a lot of voters vote from the gut. I don't know if I agree that a majority of voters vote from the gut. I think maybe a majority of swing voters that end up ultimately deciding close elections vote from the gut. But a lot of people, you know, do vote on only three or four issues rather than a broad span of issues, like some of us that are more active, you know, whether it's abortion or gun rights or health care or whatever. You know, they tend to have three or four issues that they vote strongly on and kind of ignore the kind of wider swath of issues. And I was just wondering what your thoughts were on those two things.
Well, there's a lot more gut in it than, you know, I think of issues too, but my gut is tied to those issues. When you look at how much liberals hate George Bush and how much conservatives hated Clinton, I mean, it was downright loathing, you know. And there's a lot more of it there. And there are some people that add it up. And the other thing is that people that vote on issues are often narrow about it. They're single-issue voters, whether it be gender rights or sexual orientation or immigration or whatever. But the upshot of it is that nobody's going to have any freedom if we don't straighten out some of the bigger economic and civil rights issues and privacy issues and so on. It isn't going to much matter whether your thing is stem cells or abortion or so on. And so a lot of the times the single issue or quad issue people are emotionally involved in those issues. I'm not saying that's all. There are some rational voters, but it's gotten to the point where how can you be rational when neither party does anything you want?
Yeah. And you're the difference between working class and middle class?
Control over your life and your work. I make that distinction more so than economic, although my Lord, there is. But actual control over your day-to-day life and work and the terms with which you work on and so on. Power. There's no politics without class. There's no politics without power issues of class. That's why politics exists. You wouldn't need it if everybody was equal. Yeah. And the fact that nobody acknowledged is that the issue of class is really about power, and that it benefits a few, that the many don't have any power, that the wealth can be extracted and so on. But, you know, as long as everybody's going out to the big box store and buying a pair of Dockers and getting their car waxed, they feel affluent. They feel like everything's all right. You know, wealth down inside, though, an awful lot of people in the working class are ready to lose things or damn near it or one payday away or 1 month away. And they feel like it's only happening to them. You know, the person that lost their house down the street or whatever, you feel like, well, it's just them. Yeah. You know, something went wrong. They didn't handle it right.
And unfortunately, we're at the end of this hour, and I do appreciate, though, your time. It's been very interesting. Thanks for being with us.
Well, I appreciate it, too. Thank you so much.
Joe Bagent, author of Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and Leo Duran for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.